Welcome to the Beyond Addiction Show with Josh King. This program is designed to help those who are affected by substance use. Whether you are using, trying to stop, or a loved one who wants to help, there are many effective resources, and together we'll explore them and bring you hope. Now, here is your host, Dr. Josh King.
Hello, and welcome back to the Beyond Addiction Show. I am your host, Dr. Josh King, and today we will be talking with journalist Zachary Siegel, who covers public health and mental health and has been published in the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Wired, Slate, and Politico. And this is actually a two-part episode with Zach, where the first part we're going to cover how he got into writing about mental health and specifically substance abuse, which is a particular focus of his. And then next week, we're going to talk with him about the policies of the different candidates running for president, which is really cool because I follow politics. I try to stay up with this stuff, but understanding how these policies get made and what they're saying with their policies is just not something that I spend or have a lot of knowledge about. So it's really cool to bring somebody on who is literally out in Iowa right now talking with the candidates and following them. So it feels very cool to have somebody who is that connected. But before that, I got an email from a listener, and I thought it would be good to bring in Dr. Carrie Wilkins to help me answer it. Carrie is the co-founder of the Center for Motivation and Change here in New York and in the Berkshires, and she's the co-founder of the CMC Foundation for Change. Carrie, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me.
It's so nice to have you on the show. I get to talk to you all the time and get to hear so much of your knowledge, but here is a listener who wrote in, and I was like, here's a great opportunity to help you help them out. So here is the question. She writes in that 4 months ago, my partner checked himself into a treatment program. He has alcohol use disorder. The program is based on the 12 steps, and they emphasized the importance of abstinence. Both my partner and I found the program really helpful, but now he's relapsed twice and is having second thoughts about staying abstinent from drinking. He says that he's thinking about maybe reducing his alcohol use. This isn't the first time that he's thought of this, and the past times he's tried to reduce his use, he wasn't really successful. So she's asking, is abstinence really the ultimate goal, and how do I support him if he chooses not to stay abstinent? So Carrie, what do you think?
Oh, there's so much stuff in that question. I have a lot to say about a lot of that. First of all, what you are witnessing in your partner there is ambivalence, and it is probably the most normal thing about the change process that any human being can experience. And that's true whether or not you're trying to start exercising or be on a diet or do any other behavioral change in your life, fight with your wife less, go to sleep earlier, all these behavior change, right? they all typically involve ambivalence. And when it comes to substance use issues, ambivalence is almost always at play because, you know, people don't use substances because they're crazy. They use substances because they work in some way for them. They have an effect that they like. One of the ways that we talk about it is that behaviors make sense, right? There's something about his drinking that makes sense to him. And until that's really understood and kind of unpacked and he's got alternative strategies to deal with whatever that is, it's highly likely that he's going to want to return to drinking because it's doing something for him that he finds helpful. And that can be really hard to understand when you're a significant other watching him kind of struggle.
That sounds really like a difficult thing for anybody to take in. You're in the middle of this and you're impacted by their use, and you're saying, yeah, it's actually a good thing for you to be aware of, like, hey, what are you getting out of this?
It's super important to be aware of it. And it's basically everything that's been wrong with the traditional approach to substance use disorders. And, you know, that's generally what the general public has been exposed to, you know, like shows like Dr. Drew and Celebrity Rehab and Intervention. You know, they showed a lot of confrontational approaches. They showed a lot of, you know, you just got to label the person. They've got to accept that they're an alcoholic or an addict, and they have to accept that they have to be abstinent the rest of their life. And there's no other answer to the problem, right? The reality is the science is in, and the science shows that people move in and out of substance use disorders, kind of in severity and problems associated with it. As they change, there's a lot of people who go back to drinking in non-problematic ways. There's people that go back to drinking and realize they have a problem and eventually stop. You know, the change process is really a windy, rocky road for a lot of people. But what we do know is if you hit ambivalence head on with confrontation and just tell somebody what to do, most of the time they will kind of want to do the opposite because they're not being heard right. And they want to hang on to their half, right? They're like, you say, do this. And they're like, how about if I do that?
Right.
So
right.
Engaging in a conversation about, hey, I'm worried about you. What's going on with your drinking? You know, I want to understand what's making it so hard for you to, you know, stay to these other goals. Tell me what it's doing for you. Like, I think taking the stance of curiosity and taking the stance of, is there something else I can do to make, you know, if the partner really believes abstinence is probably where things should go. And sometimes partners have witnessed a lot, you know, they've really witnessed this kind of trying to go back to moderate drinking and they've been on the receiving end of that not going so well. So of course you're probably invested in having the drinking stop, right? Mm-hmm. But can you pause, slow down and be curious and see if there are things that support your partner's efforts to abstain and make that a little bit more of a rewarding experience. You know, if abstinence is connected, if it's fun, if it's, you know, if you can help them reduce stress, if you can understand what that drinking is doing, and then try to put some other things in to replace it, it might make achieving abstinence an easier thing for your partner.
So it sounds like you're saying, abstinence isn't necessarily the ultimate goal. Even if you are saying, I'd like to be working towards it, it doesn't always have to be the goal. And that by holding that as, no, it must be the goal, you might actually be pushing somebody away from actually making change. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, very much so. I mean, it may be the ultimate goal, but right now he's saying that's not my goal. Right. So you got to pause and understand what's happening for him that he is saying that. And usually what a more traditional treatment provider would say, they would say, well, he's saying that because he's an alcoholic. Right. Well, mm-hmm. I don't even know what that means, frankly. it means a lot of things. It means some part of drinking makes sense to him. And we have to slow down and understand what that is and try to be helpful in coming up with something else to replace it. And that can often take a lot of time. You know, like if somebody's gotten to the point where they've gone to rehab and are that far in trouble with a substance, they've probably been using it for a long period of time and there's lots of habits around it. So to put those habits down and put new behaviors in is a learning process that often takes quite a bit of time and quite a bit of trial and error. So somebody may have really good intentions, but they just don't know how to do it. They really don't know how to stay sober or to abstain because there's so many habits built into drinking. So you've got to give them time to break some of those old habits and learn new, healthy, alternative behaviors.
So I could understand from this listener's email, like, and if I was in their position and listening to this and hearing this, I might be like, oh, that sounds so annoying and long. What am I supposed to do for myself as I'm waiting for them to go through this long process of change? Like, gosh, how do I take care of that? Like, I have
That's
to sit
a great
with all
question.
Of that discomfort?
That's a great question. No, and a big part of the treatment approach that we use at CMC, which is the invitation to change approach, which has an evidence-based treatment approach built into it, which is CRAFT, is a big part of that is the significant other really making sure they're taking care of themselves, getting support, you know, having, you know, alternative ways for coping yourself, ways that you take care of yourself, ways that you take care of your emotional life, you know, ways to distance yourself if your partner's drinking becomes problematic and he's doing things while he's drinking that you really don't want to be a part of or don't want to fix for him, you know, to really let naturally occurring consequences play a role, you know. So, you know, if he makes a mess while drinking, don't pick that mess up. You know, if he gets in trouble with drinking or makes somebody upset, have him have to deal with that consequence. And really, really working hard to take care of yourself in whatever way that means for you. And it's hard. It's hard when you're angry and scared and upset to slow down and take care of yourself. But it's the most important piece of the puzzle, because it's the only thing that will help you kind of stay regulated emotionally enough so that you can use good communication skills and you can be strategic in how you're thinking about helping your partner.
Okay. So far we have one: abstinence does not necessarily have to be the ultimate goal, that it can be your goal, but even within that, we have to be flexible about how we approach it. Because if we're too heavy-handed about it, it can push the person away. Yeah. Two, one of the ways to support the other person is to take a stance of curiosity. How is this helping you? What is your drinking doing for you? I want to understand it. What about this is hard? How can I help you to reduce your drinking if that's what you want to do right now, or stop drinking if that's ultimately what you want to do? And then the third thing is, I have to be taking care of myself at the same time so that I have enough energy to do this. Is that right so far?
That covers all the bases there. Yeah. And, some couples get to the point where, the person who wrote in saying, my goal would be abstinence for him, he's stating another goal. It could be that 6 months from now, you are at the point where you're like, okay, we actually don't agree. So we have to make a decision based on the fact that I'm not comfortable with your goals. I mean, that's your right as a partner too, is to say, I can't actually, that goal doesn't work for my life. There's tough decisions that have to get, be made along the way. But all I'm saying is, when you box somebody by saying the only goal that's acceptable for you, 9.5 times out of 10, you're just driving them underground, and you're literally pushing them in the direction of disagreeing with you, and locking in harder to their stated goal. And, when you're really trying to work with somebody's internal motivation, you're interested in what matters to you. What do you care about in your life? And is your drinking consistent with what you care about? Is it getting in the way of anything that you care about or that you value? And really asking those deep questions and helping the person find their reasons for changing, not being told what to do.
Mm-hmm. And so if somebody is hearing this and saying, all right, I can understand the message and I can understand why that makes sense. I still have to figure out, though, how I make some sense out of it, how I actually go and do this. Where would you send them to find out more information?
So we wrote a book, Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness
Help
People Change.
That's a good podcast name.
Yeah, it's a great name. And but that book really does have all the science in it, because I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not just talking off the cuff here. Everything that we talk about is really coming out of what evidence, actually decades worth of evidence, is about how to help people with substance use problems. So that's all in the book. You can look up things about CRAFT, community reinforcement and family training. If you want to be helpful, there's, I think you often tell people about our YouTube channel. There's free information on our website. The foundation, CMC Foundation for Change, has free stuff on the website, and that will actually have more and more free resources for people, specifically family members and parents, to be able to go on and, read things or watch videos that will help you think about, okay, like if I want to approach this problem in my family, in my house, in a different way, and I really want to be effective because I really care about my loved one and want to help them, we're going to fill that website with all sorts of resources. So that's coming soon, there's a lot of stuff up there right now as well.
And let's not forget my personal favorite, the 20-Minute Guide,
which is
the workbook version of, really, it's the workbook version of Beyond Addiction.
Yeah, yeah. There's just so much stuff now, Josh. I can't get to it all.
The one thing I don't actually refer people to is the YouTube channel, because I don't want them having to watch my face talk on their computer screen. They get enough of me in their ears. Well, Carrie, thank you so much for joining me here to help out this listener. And thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. So just to recap those points of Carrie's is, number one, abstinence is not necessarily the one way of dealing with this. And for a lot of people, they say that that is that, that they feel that that's the case, but it's not. Number two is, take a stance of curiosity. If you want to help somebody, take a stance of curiosity. Try to understand where they're coming from. Understand, what about this is hard? What about, what do you get out of your substance use? What do you get out of drinking? What do you want ultimately? How do we help you? How, where is it difficult? How can we build up a structure together? Number three, take care of yourself, because this is a process that takes a long time. And we need to actually flow with that process. The more that we can roll with it, the better we get. And ambivalence, it's a key word, ambivalence, when you're being pulled in two directions at the same time, that is at the heart of what he's dealing with. And if you can roll with ambivalence, you can do better. So get a lot of help, look up a lot of resources, and thank you so much to the listener for listening and writing in, and I hope that you found this helpful. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to have our interview with Zach Siegel.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com. Available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org. This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Joining me now is Zachary Siegel, a journalist and a writer whose focus is on public health and mental health, with an emphasis on the opioid overdose crisis. Zach has covered the many issues around this treatment and the opioid crisis, and he follows the current candidates for president looking at their drug policies. So this is the first part of a two-part series with Zach. First, we're going to talk to Zach about how he got into writing about public policy and mental health, and then specifically about substance use policy and treatment. And then next week, we're going to talk with him about the current public health policy choices that are the candidates are envisioning for the next 4 years and how those policies are developed. Zach, welcome to the show.
Hey, Josh, thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure because you've been doing some really important writing about this for a while. I've followed you on Twitter and I followed your articles. So really thank you for joining us on the show. You have some personal reasons that led you to start writing about mental health and substance use treatment, and specifically the opioid crisis. Would you be willing to share your story with us?
Yeah, I'm happy to disclose. So, I mean, if anyone Googles me, there's definitely stories about my own personal history with opioid addiction. And, you know, this really started for me in high school when I was about 17, you know, a group of friends and me, we had, really just, you know, gone down a pretty dark road of using a lot of prescription opioids. And I always think it's important to like point out here from the get-go that none of us were prescribed these opioids. We, you know, really had access to like a deep reservoir of black market pills. And, you know, things really, really turned up for me around the age of 17 or 18 when we got our hands on 80 milligram OxyContin. And now, you know, OxyContin is now this notorious blockbuster painkiller, and the manufacturers of it are, you know, being sued into bankruptcy by over 2,000 counties and attorneys general and states. So, you know, this really started for me with OxyContin in high school.
When you say that you had deep access to black market pills, what exactly do you mean? You were from an upper middle class neighborhood in Chicago, no?
Yeah, well, so like just outside of Chicago in the north suburbs. I mean, yeah, it's an affluent area, and you know, it's sort of a mystery to me how all these pills were available. So there were definitely multiple sources. The obvious one is like parents' medicine cabinet, but you know, those are prescriptions for either, you know, 30 days with a refill or two. So that's only 30 or to 60 to 90 pills or something for, which don't get me wrong, is a lot and way too much for anyone. And also, you know, like people got their wisdom teeth out. And the standard back then was if you got your wisdom teeth out and you were 17, 18, 19 years old, you would go home with 30 pills. It was this like complete random magic number, like a month of opioids for like a minor acute pain, you know, for a surgery that is probably takes only a few days to recover from. So like, there's definitely there was over prescribing going on, but then there was much more just broader diversion happening, you know, people having access to pharmacies and people stealing in bulk. So that was definitely going on in tandem with this overprescribing problem.
Well, and just to jump in with a quick aside here is actually my daughter got tubes put in her ears, which is a relatively minor surgery. And the doctor, and she was 4-5 years old, and the doctor actually offered us medication like a Tylenol with codeine for a 5-year-old, because she said, she might be uncomfortable going to sleep.
Yeah.
So, there's no way I'm taking that. What are you even doing offering that for a 5-year-old?
Right.
So it's still happening.
Still happening. And I think that, that, you know, culturally in medicine, beginning in the 90s, this movement for quote unquote patient centeredness really was the context in which this notion of pain as a fifth vital sign came into play. So right around this time, you know, when hospitals were sort of being Yelpified and patients were consumers, like God forbid anyone feel pain or leave the hospital feeling, you know, kind of sick. I mean, that these problems were sort of big factors for why just send everyone home with opioids, because they'll leave feeling good and they won't complain. And the hospital won't get dinged on any sort of metrics down the road.
Yeah. So you were 17, 18 years old, and now you're getting exposed to or getting access to OxyContin, I'm assuming with your friends.
Yes. And, you know, we had way too many of these pills. We knew they were powerful. And we were snorting them like, you know, tiny little like a hairline's worth, which would probably be about maybe 10 milligrams. And like that was enough to really knock us out. But the interesting thing here about it, about why my experience with opioids is so salient, is because when I took opioids, I didn't necessarily have the same effect that my other friends had. They would sort of nod away, fall asleep, and you know, they couldn't even make a fist. That's how sort of numbed they were. For me though, I got sort of chatty, I got sort of energetic. Like I had basically, what was happening, and this is, you know, in retrospect, what the opioid did was like lift sort of thick blanket of depression and anxiety. And so with this opioid sort of activating my system, the sort of tension like melts off my bones and I finally feel like, okay, I have a place, I feel comfortable, I feel okay. And that's a really powerful experience for like an anxious teenager. And so my experience is definitely a bit different, because when most people take opioids, they get sort of itchy, they get constipated, they might not really like the experience. I had the complete and opposite reaction.
Well, I imagine that you can't possibly be alone in that there are, you know, so many people who are getting addicted to this. They're using it for a reason, and your reason, I mean, it makes so much sense that you would want to come back and do this more, even if it's something that you're like, well, this, I know this isn't very good for me.
Right. I mean, I, like, my friends and me, we were pretty dorky. We would be on like Arrowhead.org, which is this like encyclopedia for drugs. And, you know, we would pull up the structure of the molecule for heroin and pull up the structure of the molecule for OxyContin. And they look very similar. Like, we knew what we were doing, at a sort of scientific level, but, you know, that emotionally, and that rewarding experience, overdrives a lot of, any kind of reasonable thinking that, hey, this isn't going to end well. Like, we had watched Trainspotting, we had watched Requiem for a Dream and Basketball Diaries. These are all like mostly horrific depictions of what opioids do to people. So we were not in the dark here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also experienced some personal loss.
No doubt. I mean, I think anyone who is in my age generation right now, I'm 30 years old. I would bet that most people in my generation know someone who's died of overdoses. And I can't think of another generation who has experienced this much morbidity and mortality and loss than like going back to Vietnam when kids were sent over to the jungle and many didn't come back. I feel like this generation, the loss that we've experienced hasn't really been fully reckoned with. I mean, I'm 30 years old and I've been to so many funerals, know so many people who died at the prime of their life. And that's really what gets me to journalism is, why is this happening? Why aren't we responding? What if this is an epidemic? Where's the mobilizing? Where's the response? And I think that is a lot of what motivates my work.
Mm-hmm. So how did you end up getting into treatment?
Yeah, so, you know, I think anyone who's been through the ringer and has experienced addiction treatment knows that there's always a couple false starts. So I first sort of, my parents knew at a certain point that I was pale, I was skinny, I just looked, you know, very, very ill and weak. And I think after they had noticed that like huge amounts of money are just gone and I have no explanation for where it went, and I looked like a husk of my former self, the sort of jig was up and I couldn't, you know, lie my way out of it. And so that's when I went to a behavioral health hospital outside of Chicago for a 5-day detox. And in that detox is when I was prescribed buprenorphine. I was given Seroquel. I was given Clonidine, sort of this, they're called comfort meds, and to, you know, stop the, you know, really nasty withdrawal symptoms. But the one bit of medicine I got that really helped was Suboxone, which is the brand name for buprenorphine. And so I got that inside this this detox, and that's really when things started to change for me. But it's a very it goes up and down from there, because the facility was like, you should really go to treatment, you should really go to rehab. And that's sort of the default mode, is that if someone has an addiction, they probably need to go spend 30 days inside some facility. And so what happened was I left the detox with a 30 day prescription for buprenorphine. And that's when, during this time, I enrolled into Hazelden's program in Chicago, which is like it's an outpatient facility that's connected to a sober living residence or a recovery residence. It's, there's just rules and some structure. And then during the day, you sort of do group therapy. But
Hazelden's one of the biggest, oldest, well-known names in treatment.
Right. And so, they operate on what's called the Minnesota model, which for listeners, it's a lot of group therapy. It's sort of an introduction to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's some one-on-one counseling and then some sort of like psychoeducational lectures. And a lot of this stuff was based off, work done in the 30s. And so I kind of didn't connect with it. I felt it was pretty outdated. But the biggest problem with that first stint of treatment was, in order for me to enroll and in order for me to live in the residence, I needed a doctor, a prescriber, to sign on to a contract saying that they are willing to titrate me off of the buprenorphine. That they are, and this is something I write about a lot, of this like anti-medication sentiment that is really prominent throughout the treatment industry in America. So basically they were like, we'll take you, but you're on buprenorphine and you need to start weaning off of it, which just goes against all of the evidence that we know today.
Yeah, we've talked about that before on this show. There are a few things that make me more angry than that stance, because it's like, well, we don't believe in it, so we're going to put you at real significant risk for your life.
Because we don't
like the evidence.
Right. It is about belief, and I think that addiction, it's been so siloed from the rest of healthcare that it can be treated entirely based on belief. And in other places of medicine, in other fields of mental health, that just doesn't fly, but it does here.
So we've had the fortunate luck of being able to talk to some parents who have themselves been through some pretty unfortunate situations with their children and treatment. I would say we're fortunate because we get to hear their stories and hear how they've turned that into activism. But we haven't had a lot of opportunity to talk to somebody who's been through this treatment process themselves more recently. And here you are saying that you went to one of the oldest and most respected treatment facilities in the country. And you've also written that while you were there, you were subjected to treatments that we know from research just don't work, like having confrontation groups and listening to rote lectures. What was that like for you?
It was incredibly difficult. So after that first outpatient stint at Hazelden, that, after I got off of buprenorphine entirely, I felt like crap and soon went back to heroin. And, thankfully I did not overdose and die. I was really, afraid of that. And what happened was, over the course of a few months, my parents noticed, okay, this isn't working. Like, you're back at it. We're, going back to Hazelden. And they recommended that I go to Minnesota, which is the residential inpatient facility. So there's one for adults and there's one for young people. And I was 22 at this time. And so I was sort of on the cusp. They're like, you can go to the adult one, but there it'll be a bunch of 40 and 50 year olds who have drinking problems and have lost their kids, lost their homes, and you can't relate to that. So you should go to the youth facility. And I was sort of, at the older end of that. So here I was 22. I was inside this facility. And they, again, would not give me buprenorphine maintenance. They had me on a rapid detox. So I basically was very, very sick and expected to go to lectures and do group therapy and participate in this treatment that I had already tried before. I grew up Jewish, and the first time I ever heard the Lord's Prayer was inside a behavioral health hospital. And so just like this, there was a cultural incongruity. And when I would protest and say, this doesn't make sense, this doesn't, you know, fit my values and my principles and my beliefs. I was kind of just like written off. I was dismissed as being willful, as being arrogant, as being selfish and manipulative. And that is just like antithetical to a therapeutic relationship, right?
It doesn't feel great. It doesn't feel like it's very effective or helpful.
No, it was really tough. And I'm so thankful that someone inside that facility had Albert Camus' The Stranger. So this book, I was just reading The Stranger by Camus over and over again and not reading the, you know, approved literature. So I was just sort of reading existentialism. I was reading these absurdist authors. I was trying to find my way through these philosophical and, you know, spiritual questions that were being thrown at me and trying to find my own answers and my own path, because so much of the treatment was based on your spiritual condition. And I just like did not get that. I did not need that. I was so sort of baffled. And so I just was clinging on and grabbing for anything I could think of. And it turned out that existentialism helped me get through rehab.
And so how did you end up getting into going from this, from rehabs and from really struggling to becoming a journalist who is actually making a big name for yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, like it's hard to take that distance and reflect about, you know, a name for myself. It's just like my life is wonderful today, and how I got here, I think, is really through blending the research and blending my experience and charting my own path. And so a lot of my early work, a lot of my early writing is me working through stuff. It's I'm talking to experts and I'm hearing what they say and I'm reading the literature and I'm seeing, you know, what the best way to treat an opioid use disorder is. And it's not a mystery. There's a lot of evidence out there. There's a lot of very successful treatments out there. And so I just learned that, you know, my drive to understand that and to make meaning out of my experience is, I think, what got me out of it. And I think the writing aspect, especially, it's sort of ironic that so much of writing is being alone and reading, and it's sort of this isolating experience, but the final product is something very public, and that a lot of my writing is what connects me to people today. And people will message me and we'll have conversations, and I'll go find more researchers or scholars or people who are in addiction or other experts. And I'm just constantly being exposed to brilliant people, to passionate people, to new ideas. And I think that all of that has really given me the sort of confidence to walk my own path and to find my own way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are very active on Twitter, and you are an active writer. You've written all over the place, from the New York Times to, I think, the Atlantic. You've been in the Atlantic. So a ton of different places. And in your writing and on Twitter, you seem to hold two roles. That of pushing companies and treatment facilities to do better and pushing government to find better ways of helping. But you also tend to tamp down what we might call media or human overreactions, or the natural desire to like engage in the controversy. Specifically, I'm thinking about, you wrote a New York Times article that pushed back some on the idea that everything is an epidemic, or I've seen you talking on Twitter, kind of pushing back on people who say, well, we need to really make it so hard for opioids to get out there, even as a medication. Why do you think you hold to what could be kind of opposing roles?
Yeah, so to the first question, I definitely think throughout the history of drugs in America that the media has played a central role in accelerating and selling and promoting the war on drugs. So from the earliest articles I could find about cannabis, for example, the New York Times is connecting cannabis use to people from Mexico, to migrant workers, and there's Operation Wetback. I mean, these are utterly grotesque and racist policies, and the media was selling them to white audiences as drug panics. And so when I see the media stepping back into this role of just scaring white people in the suburbs about the new threat of drugs, I think that what this does, what this fear does, is lead to knee-jerk reactionary policy. It makes us, it leads us down the wrong path of solutions. And so that's something that I'm always keeping an eye out there for, is when something is hyperbolic and sensational, I really try to push back on that, because I know throughout history, whenever that happens, there is a blunt instrument coming down the pike to deal with the problem. And so one example of that is the singular focus on prescription opioids. So yes, you know, I did just say that they're overprescribed. I did say that people get way too long of a prescription for them. But at the same time, if we just squeeze the market, if we just control the drugs, if we just get these drugs out of the market, the addiction still exists. And I think what's been happening is in our zeal to tighten the belt on the prescription opioid market, it has bled into affecting patients who legitimately need opioids. So there's a whole group of very fierce patients who have been on a chronic long-term opioid therapy for their pain, and now they're feeling the brunt of these restrictive policies. And so I definitely see ways in which this pendulum just keeps swinging through. Okay, we're just going to give everyone opioids for 30 days. Okay, now we're not going to give everyone opioids. And it's like, why can't we find a balance? Like, why can't we calibrate policy to make sure that people in pain get the drugs they need, and that those drugs do not wind up in the illicit market? That is literally the whole goal of America's prescription system for well over a century that's been in place, and it utterly fails at doing that. And so I think about, you know, that problem in the context of this with pain patients, and that's really a good example.
It's an interesting thing that you're doing there, is trying to hold two sides of saying, look, we need to do better, and we also need to not overreact, and that we as the media need to hold a space that's not sort of a both sidesing it, but just actually kind of finding a balance in the middle.
Yes, I think that's exactly it. I think if we just slowed down, if we just looked at the numbers, if we just interviewed, if we did like ethnography and anthropology, and like we really got to the bottom of who is using opioids and why they're using opioids, and having that inform the policy that can ensure that, you know, on the one hand, people with addictions, that they get the opioids they need, because methadone and buprenorphine, those are opioids too. And apparently now those are the good opioids, and oxycodone is the bad opioid. And the world we live in is too complex for good and bad. These black and white solutions just cannot adequately tackle this problem.
That is it's a tricky space that you're holding. And as a journalist, I really have to applaud it, because I spend most of my time as a therapist working with people on trying to get them out of black and white thinking and into the gray. And it's just so hard, because the world is not so much set up like that. The world actually is set up like that, but the way that it's portrayed in media is not. And so to hold that in writing, I think, is a really, really tricky stance.
It's really tricky, and it doesn't lend itself to good sound bites or quick messages and slogans, which is why I think this message is really hard to get out there. It's really hard for it to sink in, which is why I'm kind of writing like 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 word features to try to, you know, get people to slow down and to think a bit differently about this problem. And definitely, you know, that's not possible on Twitter. There's just a lot of like reaction, a lot of reaction and playing defense on Twitter. But I think the work is done when people can, you know, sit on the couch for 15 minutes and read a magazine piece and think, huh, you know, there's a different way. There's another way to think about this.
Well, we're going to be talking with you a little bit more next week about how we get those sound bites into policies. So we're going to take a break here. When we come back, well, next week, we're going to continue our conversation with Zach Siegel here to talk a little bit more about the current political landscape and how we take those sound bites and make them into policy. We'll be right back after this.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now there's a book for families who are looking to help loved ones. Beyond Addiction, How Science and Kindness Help People Change is now available at Amazon.com. Available in hardcover, paperback, and on Kindle. Pick up your copy of Beyond Addiction today. If you are a parent or a partner who is seeking guidance in helping a loved one with substance use, be sure to pick up the 20-Minute Guide. This is a terrific resource, and proceeds help the CMC Foundation for Change. Visit the 20MinuteGuide.com. That's 20MinuteGuide.com. CMC Foundation for Change is a new not-for-profit that is all about families helping families and parents helping parents through addiction from those who have been there. Over 111 million family members worldwide are affected in some way by addiction. CMC Foundation for Change helps give these families hope through support, education, and helpful resources. For more information about CMC Foundation for Change, please visit cmcffc.org on the web. That's cmcffc.org.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
This is the Beyond Addiction Show. If you have a question or comment about our show, be sure to send an email to beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Again, that's beyondaddictionshow@joshkingpsyd.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. And I really want to thank Zach Siegel for coming on and talking about his own experience. I can't imagine. I get to sit here with so many people who tell me, and they walk in and they start telling me about their own experience and everything that they went through to get to see me. And it's pretty astounding. And for Zach to come on here and to talk about this on this show that's going to go out to so many people and to write about his experience on these large outlets in The Atlantic and on Slate, it really, it's like taking off all your clothes and walking through Times Square and saying, I'm just going to be here out in the open and show myself off to people and say, here's the raw, naked me. And he did that not because, I'm sure it doesn't feel good for him to talk about all of this and to talk about his own struggles with opiates and the treatments that he went through, but to say, gosh, I went through this experience and I'm a lucky one. I came out the other end and I'm doing well and I've figured things out. But there are a lot of people who go in and they have, excuse me, they have an experience like I had. And they go into these treatments and they're terrible and it's awful. And he came out and said, I'm going to do things different and I'm going to make sure that I am having an impact on this field. And part of that is to share and to share his story. And so I just want to say thank you to him and to like all of the families that have come on and talked about what they've gone through in this show. I just so appreciate it. And it really, you think about the fact that he was at one of the leading, most well-respected treatment facilities in the country. And this was 7 years ago. And they were still doing treatments that we knew 7 years ago. We had evidence. They don't work for most people. There's not a lot of evidence that shows that it works. And that we're still running into all of these treatment facilities that say, oh, yes, we will absolutely use Suboxone, but only for detox purposes, which is like outrageously dangerous for people who are on opiates. And to think that the treatment world continues to live in a space that is just so backwards. It's just shocking to me and frustrating to me. And it makes me just so angry and so appreciative that somebody like Zach is going to take his time to put together 4,000 word stories, features to be able to say, hey, here was my experience. Here's what I saw. Can, you know, people should know this, so that they can be better informed consumers and that they can get the kind of help that they need. It's like, that's real courage. That is real courage. And I so appreciate that he was willing to do that. And honestly, he has become such a knowledgeable person in this world that I'm really excited for next week's episode, where we talk about what's going on around substance use policy in the presidential candidates. And, you know, Zach and I already talked about this. We already had that part of the conversation. So you guys are going to get it next week. I'm privy to it. Some of the stuff that he's got there is really makes you think about how we look at this in a different way. And I'm going to leave you with that teaser, but it's really going to be an interesting conversation about not just, oh, well, substance use policy, how do we fix this? But actually, how do we look at this in multiple ways? And it's cool to say, gosh, I went through this. It was not really an awesome experience. It was a difficult experience, one that didn't necessarily fit me. I'm lucky I came out the other end, but I'm going to use that as motivation to find out more. And I think there's this whole slew of journalists who are out there who are coming up. You know, Maya Salovitz is one who says, I had my experience, and she came on the show too, and she talked about her own experience and said, I got through this, but I was lucky. And so I don't want anyone else to go through that. And I just think, you know what? That's awesome. It's awesome that you're willing to do that. So I just wanted to make sure that I stated very publicly how grateful I am that people are willing to share that kind of information and that kind of time. I'm also very grateful to everyone who is spending their time listening to this show. We are up to 88 ratings, which is, we're like the slowest climbers in the world, but we're getting there, slow and steady. And so I really appreciate everyone who is taking some time to listen to the show, but then especially if you're like, you know what, I'm going to go in there, I'm going to give that rating. And if you do feel like, hey, you know what? I think I can do that. I think I can give a rating. Please, please give me a rating, preferably 5 stars, only if you think I've earned it, only if you think that this show deserves it. But the more people who rate through iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever is the new thing that Apple is going to be using, that's the number one way that we're going to get out to more people, is that we put this up there, but we also, you send it around, you tweet about it, tweet at me, at Doc Josh King. You have questions, you write them in. Clearly, I answer those questions. I respond to your emails because I appreciate the fact that anyone is going to say, I'm going to put my time, I'm going to use my precious podcast listening time to learn about this stuff and become a more thoughtful, educated consumer around therapy and around substance use treatment and around change. And, you know, I feel like hopefully we're making people into more conscientious human beings. So if that is the case and you feel like, you know what, I do feel that way, give me them 5 stars, please. If not, give me 4, give me 1, write me a note, Let me know what I can do better. Next week, we're going to be talking with Zach about politics, about the politics of substance use, and I will talk to you all then. Till next week.
Thank you for joining us this week for the Beyond Addiction Show. Join us again next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until the next program, we wish you encouragement and hope.